This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for downloading this podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. As you know, we make the Scotland Outdoors podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors. And to be honest, there was only really one thing we could talk about this week, and that was the snow.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland.
Oh, children, what an adventure today has been already. I went out to walk the dog with my daughter last night and I thought, the wind's in the wrong direction and it's blowing off the fields and there's going to be drifts tomorrow morning. So I put the car up in the village. I nearly put it at the top of the hill, which would have been a mistake because there was more drifts there, but I put it up in the village. And so I had to walk up the village this morning, pick up the car, and then I saw somebody stuck further down and this guy's trying to dig his car out just with his bare hands, and I had a shovel in the car, so I took the shovel down to him and said, look, I'm sorry, I can't stay because I've got to go to work myself, but have this shovel. And he says, this is very embarrassing. I'm supposed to be clearing this road in half an hour. So hopefully, Gritter driver, you are out by now. I'm Mark Stephen. I've made it into the BBC Aberdeen car park. Coming to you from the winter wonderland, that is Banffshire, Mr. Ewan McElriff.
Yeah, I didn't have your access to a village to leave the car. I'm snowed in. It's powdery snow. 40 mile an hour winds. It's just piling into the drifts. We've got about kind of 4 or 5 feet drifts on. Yeah, no way out. So luckily the technology is here so we can stay and do it from home. You can email us, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
We've got an email here from Oregon in the United States. This is from Erica Martin saying, I very much enjoy your programme via podcast. We were fortunate enough to visit your fine Scotland and Shetland last year in celebration of 25 years together before the shutdown. Your podcast helped us to prepare and learn more about Scotland. So many wonderful memories for us. We plan to return once it's safe to do so. Thank you for the belly laughs, mystery birds and sounds, and promoting Fruitsleeve in general. All the best to you and yours during this challenging time, Erica Martin. Well, very kind of you, Erica. Thank you very much for that. Nice to hear from Oregon. It has certainly been an awfully cold week this week. With that in mind, later in the programme, we'll be finding out about Nordic skiing. And our lockdown walk this week comes from a very, very snowy northwest near Ullapool. But first, no weather, no snow, no wind, no rain, no shine can stop the mystery bird.
Yeah, another avian brain teaser. Have a wee listen to this, because there isn't a hope that you're going to know what it is. Have a guess at that. We'll be giving you lots of clues because it's pretty hard. But if you do know what makes that sound, we'll be really impressed. Outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
I'm really struggling with this fire this morning because the wind direction is everywhere. It's all over the shop. You're either freezing one minute or it's actually melting your waterproofs the next. Today...
Moan.
I know. Today, as you will know, no doubt it's marked up in your diary, is World Radio Day. Hooray! Happy birthday to us. Happy birthday to us. 110 years of radio. That's what it is. World Radio Day is run by UNESCO as a way of drawing attention to the continued cultural worth. I can't even speak. I'm going home now. Cultural worth of radio.
You think after 110 years you would have got the hang of it. Anyway, we found out about this
from Professor Alison Phipps, who is UNESCO Chair for Integration at Glasgow University. She got in touch with us to tell us, I love this, this is a way to get on the radio, she'd nominated us to UNESCO as her favourite radio show.
It's magical. It's also quite funny because I've certainly found with people that we've done this with from the Horn of Africa, there's quite a bit of work to be done to persuade people about that the ground will be very, very wet. And that really, you will need several layers, and a pair of gloves would be a good idea. So there's all those things that are about living in a temperate maritime climate, which tends, particularly on the west coast of Scotland, to be damp. And we've got all of these, you know, kind of Instagram shots of, you know, members of the family and our foster family, standing on top of the cobbler, and watching them, you know, super fit, and just seeing these pictures of people posing on top of these rocks in Scotland, you know, kind of doing a Titanic style pose, you kind of see people in a moment of unadulterated joy in a landscape that they're part of too. And I think there's something about those images and those experiences of taking people up the mountains after we've managed to wrestle people into a good stout pair of shoes that is absolutely wonderful.
You spent time in New Zealand. What did you learn about how they interact with the land there?
And I think one of the really interesting things I learned there was the way that Kiwis were trying to learn to live in an uneasy and difficult and steady reconciling relationship with what the settler colonial past had been and what the indigenous Māori past had been, and what an interweaving might look like in the present. I remember first meeting a Māori bushman in the Orawaras, and he just, after I'd done my mihi, after I'd explained to him who I was and what my mountain and my river and my canoe was, which happened to be a particular aircraft, he said, "Do you know, when you people first came over, we called you refugees, because they showed us the pictures of the Gorbals in Glasgow that you'd all come from, and you were refugees." And that opened out into really quite a rich conversation about a concept of manaakitanga, which is the Māori word, manaakitanga, for hospitality. It's a word which is a duty which many, many Indigenous cultures, including those of our own within Scotland, feel are vital. It was really as I was learning those traditions that there are of hospitality and how it is to be performed and how it is not wrong initially to treat a stranger with a degree of caution, as what the poet David Wagner has called as a powerful stranger who might make you feel lost, that there's a real wisdom in that. So in not rushing headlong into "We'll welcome everybody regardless," but also in not going, "We won't welcome anyone, we'll be really suspicious, we need everything for ourselves," but actually in taking time to step gradually towards the other, to learn about the other, to allow that to be a process that takes time. And one of the things, particularly in parts of Aotearoa New Zealand that I was witnessing, was the way that the Crown had come to settlements with Māori that meant that the land was given back to particular Māori groups, Māori iwi or Māori tribes, for their stewardship, with financial settlement too. For example, the land of the Orawaras, which had been held by the Department of Conservation, lapsed from being stewarded by the Department of Conservation and by the Crown, and was returned to the stewardship of Māori to steward in the way that they wished to. And that has then led to the work that's gone on to recognise the land as having a legal personality, and of the need for Māori for human beings, for visitors to that area of New Zealand and to New Zealand itself, to exercise what's called kaitiaki, which means a care for the landscape. An understanding of almost a human ecology that means that the land must be respected, its rights as a living, breathing, growing entity should be taken into account. And for me, that was something I brought back and thought, gosh, what would that look like in Scotland if we granted legal personality to the remnants of the Caledonian rainforest, for example, or to particular mountains or particular areas, to geoparks, to places like St Kilda, what would that look like? And that would take on even further the cultural and environmental justice work that UNESCO does with its World Cultural Heritage sites and with its geoparks and with sites of special scientific interest and with our own national parks, which are often geared towards an economic or a tourism interest. So I came back with lots of thoughts and ideas, which are, you know, obviously part of my job to think with and about, but were about offering a refuge as well to the land. But in many ways, you know, some of the ways in which we've treated the land, clambered over it, ploughed it up, raped and pillaged it, scorched the earth. You know, some of the ways we've behaved and the metaphors we've used towards the land are not unlike some of the ways we've behaved towards women and children who've sought refuge, and that there might be something about considering giving refuge to the land, giving the land a break too, in the way that we give people a break and watch them rewild themselves, return. I know it's a problematic term, but return to a state of being that maybe is just more soothing, is less driven by the algorithms and maybe a little more like the rhythms that I find, the serenity that I can find in listening to your voices on a Saturday morning or in the small hours of the morning when I'll be lulled to sleep.
Professor Alison Phipps there, who's UNESCO Chair for Integration at Glasgow University. Now, they say confession is good for the soul. I'm not entirely convinced, right? I didn't cue into that piece correctly. What should have happened was, Ewan said, as her favourite radio show, I was then supposed to say we were flattered. We were also intrigued to find out about the work she does with refugees and asylum seekers and how that relates to the outdoors. And you were supposed to say...
So I asked her, what's it like taking a refugee up their first Monroe in Scotland? But somehow that didn't appear.
No, some of that didn't appear. And she'd be then going to say, it's magical, it's also quite blah, blah, blah. Some of it didn't appear because 110 years of radio, no one has got to grips with how you're actually supposed to broadcast in quite strong winds wearing woolen gloves. And it was over the page and I couldn't do it. It's as simple as that. So, Alison, I'm sorry, it should have made more sense, but that's just the way it works sometimes.
If you'd like, in the good old days, you would have had staff for that,
yes,
just to hold it for you.
Yeah, true.
You know, like, Charles Dickens' wife holding his pencil for him.
Yes, yes, exactly the simile I was thinking of. If you'd like to hear more of our conversation with Alison, you can get your ears around the latest edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available now from BBC Sounds. What she was talking about there, about the land being a legal entity in and of itself in New Zealand, I think is a fascinating concept.
I think it's someone we should have a look at a bit more because, you know, without getting into the revolution and certainly not having a go at particular groups, but there is a duty to leave a mountain, say, in its prime natural condition for generations to come. Nobody should have the right to change it or abuse it. And it's a really interesting concept. It's something we'll be exposing with David Valhari in an upcoming podcast now in charge of the John Muir Trust. That whole responsibility for the land. You know, what right have we got to damage it?
Yeah. My gut instinct is there are big changes happening in how we view land, how we accord it legal status, for example, how we see it in terms of carbon capture, all these things. There's a lot of discussions going on at the moment which will fundamentally change potentially how Scotland looks, and we're very much looking forward to exploring it. We started off with Oregon. We've now got from Texas. They're saying, I have my whiskey and my fire, but there aren't much more than chickens and lady hawks out here. Good luck on the mystery bird, Lyric Foster. Thank you very much, Lyric. I have to tell you, somebody has got the mystery bird correct already.
It's ridiculous. How could anybody know what that is? Unless it was just a wild guess. We'll give lots of cues. I'm going to give a cue now. They were once used to treat gout.
Never leave home without one. Back in the early weeks of January, I came up with the idea of walking the Fermartin Buchan Way. It's the former railway line between Dyce and Maud, and Maud was kind of the junction, and you can either go to Fraserburgh or Peterhead. Now, I'll be honest, the current weather has put paid to progress, but I did manage to get out before the snow came good and proper.
Come into the garden, Maud, for the black bat night has flown. That's where I am, Maud, in Aberdeenshire, though nobody refers to it as Maud here. M-A-U-D. It's Maud. I left the house this morning thinking, actually, this is not bad. And there was a blink of sunlight. Things were thawing. And it's completely different up here, 35 minutes away. The track in places is sheet ice. I've got the bike with me, but I really don't know whether it's going to go today or not. I have to confess, I don't know Maud terribly well, which is strange, you know, but it sort of sits between places. I've been through it several times, but I don't think I've ever actually stopped and spent time here. And like a lot of these wee villages and towns, you find yourself thinking, yeah, but what was it for originally? What did they do? This says, Maud to Strachan. This is one of the few sections still with a recognisable station. The old railway building is home to the Railway Museum. However, it's only open in summer. Yeah, of course. To the south of Strachan lies the stone circle and the remains of the old 17th century parish church alongside the new church built in the 19th century. Just north of Strachan lies Mormont Hill. It overlooks the surrounding countryside and hosts the outline of a giant horse formed by white stones. It's believed to be made in honour of an officer who died in 1794 at the Battle of Gilsen in the Netherlands after he gave the local laird his horse. Well, that was daft. Okay. See, that's a sign. I went to mount the bicycle and the bicycle fell over. It's telling me something. See how this goes. So far so good, it feels okay, but I've been fooled before. Now, Ochnagat, 4.5 miles that a ways. National Cycle Network 1 for Martin and Buchan Railway. Strachan, 5.5 miles this way. This is interesting here too. There is what is clearly a badger set in the side of the railway cutting here. There's one entrance there, two entrances. There's a huge amount of material being dug out here and just dumped. There's another, what, one, two, three entrances. I don't know how many animals would be in there. But without a word of a lie, the hole closest to me has got a pile in front of it that must be at least 3/4 of a ton or a ton of material. Slightly orangey, almost clay soil. In and amongst it, there's a lot of dead grass and things. Old bedding that's just been cleaned out. It would be worthwhile coming back here some evening and just quietly watching. Might well do that. Another hole, and another hole, and another hole, and another hole. This thing is huge. That's the biggest badger set I've seen in a long time. The colour's coming back into the world now. And just on my right-hand side, at the bottom of this embankment, there's an old dry-stained dike. And there are trees behind it, which means down there must be really moist, doesn't get much in the way of sunshine. So in the foreground, you've got these birch trees right at the top. And they're sort of creamy and honey-coloured, and it goes right down to a sort of damson, almost, and some of the upper branches. The dry-stained dike looks like it's covered in green baize. It's just so covered in moss, and there's a dead tree. And what made me stop here is this fungus growing on top of the tree, which is almost a bright orange colour. Certainly, you know, quite a strong caramel. And you've got that offset against this green, almost fuzzy background. And again, it just jumps straight out at you. It's lovely. I need to be paying more attention to this track because this is icier than I thought it was. There are ash trees and sycamore trees either side of the line here, and I can more or less guarantee, see if you were to cut one of those down and count the rings, they would date back to when this line was shut. Prior to that, the railwaymen would have kept them down, kept the line clear either side. Every so often on this Fermartin and Buchan Way, I've passed these little huts, railwaymen's huts. They're usually made of sleepers, corrugated iron roofs, and they're not big, but the size of a large garden shed, essentially. But what a blessing they must have been to those guys, because they were out in all weathers, 365 days of the year, checking that everything was secure, that the line was all there, that water hadn't washed anything away, you know, replacing gravel. And to be able to get out of the weather occasionally, because these little huts have almost all got chimney breasts, and put on a fire and get the kettle on, and just sit there out of the rain or the snow and have your fly cup or your lunch and just get a bit of feeling back into your hands. A blessing, right enough.
You can hear more of me skating about in the Fermartin Buchan Way coming up very shortly. We actually got an email about the walk I'm currently doing in stages, walk cycle. Henry Marston from Rotherham got in touch and said, listening to recent editions, I've been intrigued by Mark's walk along the old railway, the Fermartin and Buchan Way. Ahead of the last episode, please enlighten us, why this name? There doesn't seem to be any towns or villages named either Fermartin or Buchan in the area.
Yeah, it goes on to say, I admire you doing the links from outside in the BBC Aberdeen car park and the car park at Banff, rather than the cosy studio. Or is it they won't let you in?
The latter.
I think it's probably the latter one. But I was loving to hear you say some of the names. Achnagat, I remember one of the first interviews I did for the BBC. And this guy says, a loon carry craw himself a man till he's won the open bowling at Achnagat. Fantastic. I'm not even going to try and translate that. No. But yeah, why is it called? It's intrigued me. I get the Buchan bit, but why the Fermartin bit?
Well, both. It's interesting that they're not regional or council areas. They're what are known as committee areas. Fermartin is the area between basically the River Don and the River Eithen. So that area there. And would include where the railway line actually started off in Dyce. But Buchan it's basically the area starting off roughly about Fraserburgh and going right the way across the top of the coast in the Murray Firth there. So the line went to Fraserburgh, the line went to Peterhead, it connected up with Aberdeen, hence Buchan Fermartin. That's it. That's as much as I can do. You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. We've got heaps more coming up, including a picturesque harbour that's been in the news this week. And very shortly, we find out about a young people's forest project.
Yeah, there's quite a few people having a go at the birds. Somebody's got it right already, but
incredible.
I'm just dumbfounded that somebody got this right. I may have to start dropping some clues in here. It's almost unique in the world, but here, have a listen. If you're listening in Oregon, or you're listening in Texas, or even if you're listening in Luton, you won't hear that noise, not that particular one. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, but it's a really distinctive looking bird.
Now, obviously, for reasons of maintaining, I mean, the heart-gripping tension, which is the lifeblood of this programme, we're not going to give you the correct answer yet, but here are some wrong ones. Wilbur in Edinburgh thinks it's a canary. Stuart Robertson and Pollock, Derek Listening in Forth, and Gary in Pennycook. No, that's a lie, actually. Stuart and Derek both thought it was a pied wagtail, and Gary in Pennycook thought it was a house martin.
Well, you can see where they're coming from.
Yeah.
Can I give you a fantastic piece of trivia? The Canary Islands got their name because it was infested with dogs. Canaries.
Interesting.
Not been a wasted day after
No, absolutely not. Earlier this week it was announced that Scotland is creating its first young people's forest. It will be one of the flagship projects as the country prepares to host the United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP26, in Glasgow later this year. Now, to tell us what a young people's forest is and how it will work is Louise McDonald, Chief Executive of Young Scot, one of the organisations involved. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Absolutely freezing. Without a word of a lie, I've got my feet set up in two blocks of wood. That's how cold it is. What exactly is a young people's forest? Where did the idea come from?
Well, the idea came from young people themselves, actually. So Young Scot were the young people's charity in Scotland. And over the years, we've done a lot of work with a whole range of different organisations about how you involve young people in the environment. And we've done work in forestry and all sorts of different issues like that. But for many years, we actually worked with what was SNH and now Nature Scots to establish ReRoute, which was a panel of young volunteers who supported the team at SNH Nature Scot to involve young people in the biodiversity strategy. And that evolved, and you know, the young people have really done some amazing work there. But that work's kind of come to an end. And essentially, during autumn 2019, some of those young volunteers were involved in a conversation about what a young people's forest in Scotland would look like. It happened because there is already one down in Derbyshire, which is run by the Woodland Trust. And we'd heard and spoken to them. But with COP26 planned, we kind of thought, what else could, what could happen with that? And so the key question that we asked the young people was, anyone with enough resources can plant a forest, but what would it mean to be a young people's forest? And so basically the young people came up with the idea, they thought about it, they talked about all the different ideas that they had, and they've come up with this vision that they basically, what they've said is, we want this to be a 100-year vision for a forest that is entirely owned, all decisions made by young people themselves.
Well, can I give an example of the practical things the young folk are going to be doing?
Yeah, so the starting point is to bring some young people together. So we're about to kind of recruit for the panel of young people who will pull this idea together. And first of all, they're going to do the work over the next few months about what model do they want? Because that first group of young people were thinking about, is it one single forest? Is it lots of forests? Is it a ribbon of forests across Scotland? They were really thoughtful about inclusion and accessibility. So how do you factor those things into a forest? Yes, they wanted it to be a place that's multi-use for education and leisure and so on. But they also, the young people were incredibly thoughtful about it being a place where people and nature are in balance. So what does that mean? So the young people that we pulled together and we recruit, the recruitment will be opening soon, so keep an eye out for that. We'll start to work up the plan. They'll start to kind of say, right, where will it be? They'll start to look at possible sites. They'll start to negotiate sites, and that could be derelict land or other types of land. We just don't know because it's up to the young people to decide. So they'll basically kind of move through that whole period over the summer, doing all of the kind of planning. And what the aim is that by the end of the year, by November, that the young people are in a position to announce where and what it will be, and have the first trees that will be planted on site.
Louise, we've only got a couple of minutes to the news. So you mentioned recruitment there. How is that going to work? What are you recruiting? What for?
So this is for the young people themselves that will lead this project. So we'll be recruiting for a panel of volunteers, and that will be across all of the Young Scot channels and our partners, YouthLink Scotland as well. So you know, young people can find out about that if they just keep an eye on the Young Scot channels. And we want young people from across Scotland, from urban and rural communities, island communities. And we're also really keen on young people who perhaps have never engaged in this kind of thing before, but are really interested in finding out more about how these things work. And so we're really keen to hear from young people from across Scotland aged between 11 and 26.
Good stuff. Listen, Louise, thank you very much for joining us this morning. That was kind of you.
Thank you.
That was Louise McDonald there from Young Scot. It's a great idea. You know, to a certain extent, I'm slightly surprised that young people are excited about it.
Well, I remember when I was a teenager, I was out doing conservation work and conservation corps stuff. People care about it, you know, it's kind of a cliche, but it's their future. And it fits in really nicely with the talk we were having earlier on about the ownership of land. Yeah. Part of a whole new movement of, actually, we've got it's important to leave a legacy.
Yeah. And certainly with the wind picking up, the importance of having a shelter belt of trees somewhere is becoming increasingly obvious. It's just, yeah, I've got the fire balanced on a pile of snow here at the moment. Anyway, coming up, no ski centres open at the moment, sadly, but how about some cross-country skiing and some bothy base? Prepare to be amazed.
Truly incredible. And quite a lot of people very disappointed they're getting this mystery bird right. But have a listen. Flying through a Scottish pine wood.
Big clue. Big, big clue. Jake and Bucky reckons is a red wing, a visitor from Scandinavia. No, Jake, it is not. And I hope the treehouse caravan is fine and toasty in this weather. Alan, Canvas Baron, says it might be a song thrush. Nope, sadly not.
Might be.
It might be, but it's not. Then we've got a comment here from Eric and Joe, Hill of Fishery, saying, any chance of a wee mention for Eric and Joe? No, sadly we can't, Eric and Joe, sorry about that. Beeble and Snatty, up in a snowy hill of Fishery, love the snow, love the show, mention to Sean the snowplow driver, who is trying to keep the road accessible. Slanger. Well, fine. Well, hello, Sean. Crack on. David, the 50% Aberdonian in Edinburgh, says, my limited understanding is that Maud was the site of a cattle mart before the railway, which was attempting to reach Peterhead. The line was built to Maud to get cash. The money is in the freight, not passengers. Interestingly, David, the part of the line that stayed open longest was for freight, not for passengers. Anyway.
Back to the 1970s. Ken Rundle's been in touch about Maud. Says it was one of the biggest cattle markets in Scotland and it always got the top prices in the 1960s. And it also points out the connection with Maud and the States, because the Forbes family used to come from Maud and they moved to set up the Forbes magazine. And partly the family come back for a picnic every year, not this year obviously, but to cement the family connection.
For many of us, this is the first proper snow we've had for many a long year. And to be frank, we make no excuse for revelling in it. The other week, I explored different kinds of ice that can form. This week, it was a no-brainer. I'm taking a closer look at the snowflake.
You know, looking at snow this week has been something of a no-brainer, because we've had a lot of it. By and large, it's fallen gently and quietly in near windless conditions, so it shrouded the land and the trees, the house and the cars. It built up on the woolly backs of sheep over there, and it softened every hard edge. It deadens sound, and it makes the landscape pure and perfect. Now, the snow has hidden some things, but it's revealed others, the tracks of birds and animals. Our horses have left long, looping tracks through virgin snowfields, showing where they've been that day. It's a sort of Strava for cuddies. And I keep on seeing little stories, little dramas all over the place. Right here is where a young fox has stood poised, one foreleg raised before a snowbank, listening hard for scratching or tunnelling noises in the snow, before it's obviously leapt straight up and dived muzzle first into the drift to grab some poor, unsuspecting vole. Snowflakes form when tiny ice crystals form around dust or pollen and clouds and start to stick together. Once they become heavy enough, they fall to the ground. Snowflakes aren't actually white, they're translucent, but the way light passes through them causes them to appear white. Now, everybody knows that no two snowflakes are identical. What everybody thinks of as a classic snowflake shape is a dendrite snowflake, which looks a bit like a six-pointed star. To be honest, I'm a bit woolly on the physics, but apparently it's to do with how oxygen and hydrogen molecules combine to form water. The six-sided shape is just something that H2O is comfortable with. The other thing that everybody knows is that snowflakes are beautiful things. In 1865, just after the end of the American Civil War, a man called Wilson Bentley was born in Jericho, Vermont. Now, given that he went on to become known as Snowflake Bentley, this was a pretty astute move on his part, because Jericho gets an awful lot of snow, about 10 feet of the stuff every year, and Snowflake became obsessed by it. For his 15th birthday, he got a microscope, and 4 years later, having also acquired a camera,
he somehow managed to combine the two bits of kit to take the world's first photograph of a snowflake. He would stand for hours in the freezing cold waiting for a good example, and when one landed, he'd use the tip of a feather to move it gently under the lens. With the primitive gear he had, he needed long exposures, about a minute and a half. But the results were just enchanting, stunning. The Smithsonian Institute still has about 500 examples of his work, which is about a tenth of all the photographs he ever took of snowflakes. Snow is beautiful, but it can also be deadly. I've got an old book published in 1966 called Avalanches and Snow Safety by a scientist and researcher, Colin Fraser. Now, Fraser worked in Switzerland with the Passendienst, the precursor of today's ski patrollers, looking at how snow behaves in different conditions and testing different ways to make snow slopes safe. Some of their methods, to be honest, sound a bit Halley Racket, but they weren't the first. In 1933, the director of the Bernina Railway in Switzerland experimented with rockets and mortars to set off avalanches to protect the rail line. Inspired by this lunacy, the Passendienst used to take commercial-sized baked beans tins, beans had been eaten first, obviously, and replace them with dynamite. They'd then climb up the reverse side of the slope, the other side of the hill effectively, light the fuse and lob the fizzing tins over the ridge. This was very much a case of beans means bangs, but it did clear the snow. Some fool, and the finger of suspicion points firmly at the Swiss Army, then lent them a recoilless rifle, which is a kind of pretty accurate artillery piece. They knew they couldn't aim the thing in whiteout conditions, which are quite common around Davos, so they set up pre-arranged aiming stakes just in front of the rifle, which would allow them to fire blind. Each stake pointed to a different slope or ridge. Incredibly, this actually worked pretty well until some kids played with the aiming sticks, moved them, and the Passendienst accidentally blew up some poor bloke's garage. I mean, let's face it, that could have happened to any of us. I'll leave you with something that you might like to try. The Victorians used to preserve spiders' webs by cementing them between two thin sheets of glass. Incredibly, you can do the same thing with snowflakes. All you need is snow, obviously, a piece of black cardboard, superglue, microscope slides, a fine-tipped paintbrush, and a magnifying glass. Oh, and a freezer. Now, I'm not going to go into the precise methodology here. To be honest, I haven't tried it myself yet, but the results look absolutely stunning. It does work. Just look it up online. I mean, let's face it, there's a lot of snow out there. Chances are you're probably not going anywhere anytime soon anyway. It'll give you something to do.
I have got to give that a go.
But how do you go about preserving it then?
It's something to do with superglue. I remember reading somewhere that they use the fumes from superglue sometimes to make very faint fingerprints stand out. You know, if this is forensic science, stand out. Mm-hmm. And it's something to do with you drop the snowflake onto a small puddle of super glue and then sandwich it between two bits of glass. You then have to let it dry, which takes an awfully long time, obviously at sub-zero conditions, in the freezer. But when you take it out, the super glue has adopted the shape of the snowflake and you can see it. And you can hold it up to light and there's the snowflake and it's there for perpetuity thereafter. I think it's a great idea.
Unbridled enjoyment in the Stephen household today.
If only I could find my microscope slides.
You were talking about that avalanche thing. I was up on, I think you went as well, up on Annaghmore when they were setting off explosives to do it. You know, it's a real Seven Brides for Seven Brothers stuff.
Yeah.
Must be great fun.
Yeah, it was. It was. The only thing is that, you know, it does make a lot of sense when you say you're setting off avalanches. You set off the avalanches in an attempt to clear the slope so it doesn't build up till, so it becomes really, really dangerous. You know, you're releasing it early all the time. That's the idea. Effectively, it's just like kind of sweeping the back step. Sticking with snow, and another way to make the most of it, Nordic skiing. To tell us all about it is chair of the Huntley Nordic Ski Club, Roy Young. Good morning, Roy. How are you?
Good, thank you. Yeah, just enjoying. I'm going to go and try that that snowflake trick. That's got to be done.
Have a look online. It does. I'm sure it's more difficult than it looks online. But you know, I think if you managed it, it'd be a huge sense of satisfaction. Nordic skiing. Is it the same as cross country skiing classically?
Nordic probably covers a little bit more than just cross country. So cross country is travelling over the ground, but Nordic will also cover ski jumping is considered a Nordic skiing sport. So yeah, people jumping off 80 metre towers is called Nordic as well. Haven't tried that one, to be honest.
It's hard work though, isn't it? I've done the track at Huntley, and you've got to be pretty fit to do it.
Well, it depends. It depends what level you want to do it at.
I was at the bottom.
Most people go out for a bike ride, and you know, most of us pedal nice and easily and just enjoy the bike ride. And people go out there and hammer the Tour de France. And it's the same sort of thing in cross country. You can do it at your level. If you go for a walk with a little bit of a slide, you're getting an advantage of being on the skis. But you don't need to sort of don lycra and dash around fast. Having said that, it definitely uses up some calories while you're doing it. But I see that as an advantage, and it gives me an excuse to have a bit of cake when I get home.
Yeah. Why Huntley, though? Is Huntley particularly good for Nordic skiing?
The ground, you know, the geography, I guess, leads Huntley to have good skiing on its doorstep. There's Gartley Moor just off the A96 above Huntley, which has, well, I know this year has been awesome. And it often gets snow early in the season, but out towards Rhynie, there's just beyond Rhynie, about 5 miles from Huntley, there's the Clashendarroch Forest, which is actually a huge forest. It's a massive forest and has a tradition of snow holding. There's a car park at about, it's 250-300 meters above sea level. And that just seems to be a trigger. You get snow, it lasts there, and the forest just protects that snow for longer. So, yeah, we've got loads of snow in the town at the moment in Huntley, but when the snow goes here, normally you get about a week to 10 days of snow continually in the forest. So it's always been a snow-holding area, and that's what's made it attractive to cross-country.
You are the coach of the national squad, I believe, and your loon, Andrew, is currently looking forward to the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing. You know, how hard do you have to train for something like that?
Majorly hard. Yeah. I mean, it's a full-time, some very long days working really hard. So, it's probably one of the hardest sports. The nutritionist working with the team at the moment has worked with professional cycling teams. In fact, he's still working with one of the professional cycling teams, and he says that the guys they train harder than the Tour de France cyclists do. They work very hard.
That's another sport crossed off the list. It must have been brilliant though the last couple of weeks. So I mean, I'm looking at an absolute winter wonderland at the moment. I was out sledging yesterday. It's just great.
Oh, it's been incredible. I mean, yeah, I don't think. I mean, 2010 and 2011 were really good snow years. We average 44 days. I think is the current average number of days of skiing in the Clashendarroch. Annually, this year we've had over that, and that's just been in one continual trend. Has been over 40 days of continuous skiing in the forest.
Wow.
So far this year. So yeah, it's been amazing. In fact, the forest is so full of snow. The club runs a pisting machine, which it's a Skidoo We drive around the forest to just make it a bit easier for people to ski up there. And we haven't had it out for 2 weeks because of the amount of snow. There's been road closures and stuff, but everyone's been skiing much more locally because of that. So yeah, been an amazing season so far.
We are maybe misrepresenting the activity as being sweaty and highly competitive and blah blah blah. But I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, if you were able to get out in the forest with the skis and the silence and the snow just sitting on the trees, it must be just so peaceful, so relaxing.
Yeah, well, that's I certainly find it like that. I was thinking when I was asked to speak, and I was skiing 2 days ago, and the skis were just moving, and you could actually hear the sort of crisp snow coming over the skis. There's a very faint noise, and that was the only noise around. It was amazing. It was a lovely day. I mean, Thursday was bright and sunny and pretty chilly, but it was just lovely to be out and skiing in those conditions.
Roy, it sounds idyllic. Roy Young, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
It's Roy Young now, who runs the Nordic Skiing up in Huntly. I used to have a set of Nordic skis. I was never very good
really?
At them. Yeah. I found them in a skip at Thainston Mark, to be honest. But
that is as much of your personal training equipment.
Not much. All. And the boots came with it, and they were the right size too until the mice ate them. Anyway, talking about skiing, I've seen umpteen examples and spoken to umpteen people who, what they've been doing is old-fashioned. I mean, basically just, you know, the ski areas aren't open, so they've been taking the skis, downhill skis, climbing up hills like Benny Hee and what have you, and then skiing back down again. So if you've done that, you know, and you've had a great experience, let us know about it.
I tell you, first time ever, I've had decades of using plastic sledges that weren't very good in stubble fields. Mm-hmm. And I got a nice wooden one, but it's got thin rails, so you need almost ice to make it work. Ah. Last week, my wooden toboggan arrived, and it is absolutely fantastic. And you know when you get that stubble field and there's maybe 3 inches of snow, and it just scoots down it. It's just a joy.
I did see the photograph. Where did you get that from?
Colorado.
I mean, classic sort of, you know, Citizen Kane type sledge. Let's go back to the Fermartin Buck and Way now. I'm on the stretch of the old railway line between Maud and Stricken. It is extremely, extremely icy. Early on the strip, sheep had taken my interest, and yet again, my attention is drawn inexorably back towards them. No more cycling at the moment. Just far, far too icy. It's just this one section, and it must be heading due north. And it's just sheet ice. Just creeping along, trying not to fall in a big heap. Feel the neeps off to the right hand side there. And somebody's let his yows into it. And he's strip grazing it. So the green is all gone, you know, all the neep tops, and the neeps are halfway eaten down into the frozen ground. So there's all these yellowish dots, custard coloured. But the yows, oi, they are filthy, absolutely mocked. I put up a picture on my Twitter feed last week of a sign I'd seen locally saying Dubs on road. Dubs is the local word for mud. And somebody came back and said, that's got a vague memory of Scotland the what. Yes, indeed, there was a farmer who hailed from mains of Sharney Dubs. Sharn is what falls out of the back end of a sheep or a cow or a pig. Ah, me. But those sheep are just the same colour as the ground. There's some of them have got a slightly lighter strip of wool across their backs, but otherwise they are just black.
Well, this is irritating. I stopped in Strachan because I wanted to go and see the Stone Circle, which is about 700 metres, according to the sign, from the track. But I can't get up this path. It's compacted snow and ice, and I just can't get enough traction to actually get up it. It's ludicrous. Now, you may well ask the question, and it's a good question. Why don't you put your foot spikes on, Mark? Well, they're back in the car. Stupid, stupid, stupid. Aye, aye. But this is a really nice piece of railway construction here. The path follows an embankment past Strachan. So there is a bridge here which goes, takes you underneath the railway line. And that's a track into these woods. But off to the left-hand side of that, there is another opening. And that carries this burn. So I'm struggling to even get over this footbridge, which is the most extraordinary reddish colour. There is a place down near Glasgow called the Red Burn, and it's soft red sandstone that washes it all the time, and the water is quite red. So is this, a sort of reddish-brown colour. It's not peaty. Bizarre, you'd almost think it was rust. And that carries across the other side of this wee footbridge that somebody's built, very picturesque. And there's a gate there for controlling the flow of water off to the left-hand side, which would tend to suggest a mill laid, but I can't see anything that even approximates to a mill building down there. But it's a nice place to stop for the day. I had to walk about 3/4 of a mile on the verge there, pushing the bike, because it's just lethal. But worst places to stop for a bite of lunch. There's a wee bench down here. I'll get my bubble wrap out yet again. And then, once I've had a cup of coffee and some biscuits and cheese, head back, pick up the car again. That's actually been a very pleasant morning.
Well, there you go. Someday, I promise, I will get to the end of this particular railway. I know I did the West Highway in 6 days. This has taken me months.
It's incredible. What I don't understand...
Many, many things.
...is how you have any bubbles left after you've sat on it.
Oh, that's not nice. That's not nice.
Well, no,
you do get heavy-duty bubble wrap.
Okay, all right.
There is a slight popping noise, but that's normal.
Usually also find that you've had a child who's popped them all.
Ah, no. No, you see, I keep it carefully concealed inside my rucksack.
Ah. I'm just going to say the rooks have arrived.
Oh, yes.
Thousands of rooks just sitting in the trees above me. It's quite spooky.
Well, you said that photograph. It's the way they're lining up facing your house is a bit alarming.
We basically describe it. There's about 5 rows of thousands of rooks, and it looks like they're at a refectory dining table. I presume it's barley that's been spilled badly. Sorry, Charlie. And they're germinating in long lines now, but I'm not sure.
I don't know. Make it sound like Hogwarts. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yep, you can catch up whenever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or download the Free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. We like hearing where you listen to the podcast. You can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Ron Gall did. Says, good afternoon from southern Spain. I've just completed listening to your 6-day podcast of your experiences undertaking the West Highland Way.
Yeah, it goes on to say, as someone who goes out walking every day, I really found these podcasts and the others from the Scotland Outdoors stable enjoyable to listen to. And while we've a great walking here in Spain, it's encouraged me to give this Scottish route a go, subject, of course, to open airways and the resumption of something approaching normal times. Thanks for making the programmes. Best regards from Spain. Richard Gall.
How much are you enjoying it, Stuart, just being Scotland captain?
For me, Luke, I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying the responsibility. I'm enjoying that. a chance to lead our nation.
The BBC Radio Scotland Rugby Podcast with Andy Burke and Tom English.
If you won that game, where would that have ranked, do you think, in the Hastings Calcutta Cup?
I think I'd have got the head of the table chair at Christmas. I think that would have been me, actually.
News and stories from the Six Nations and the Scottish Game.
You left Scotstoun as a boy and you're coming back a man.
A da.
The BBC Radio Scotland Rugby Podcast.
This is quite incredible!
Available now on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio Scotland, there's absolutely no doubt about that. Unlike the identity of our previous correspondent, Ron Oblique Richard Gall. We've got both down here, so we're assuming it's Richard because he signs himself off that way, so apologies for the misnomer, Richard.
You're listening to... you don't tune in this programme for accuracy.
No. Well, not if you did, you'd be disappointed.
Yeah, still time to hazard a guess at the mystery bird. Here's your final chance.
Craig in Bearsden thinks it's a cool tit. I think you probably mean cold tit, Craig, but never mind. It could be in this weather, nobody knows. Seamus from Spot says, is it a crested tit? Duncan from Nairn says, is the mystery bird a very young domestic chicken of unknown breed? Duncan, we're going to send somebody around to you in a minute. Wendy from Montrose says, is the bird a crested tit? No. Keith Dolan says, just about to head out for a lovely morning winter walk. I'm going to take a guess at the mystery bird. Is it a tree creeper? Great show as usual, keep up the great work. Nice of you to say so, Keith, but sadly you're wrong. And Florence Fisher also thought it was a crested tit. None of these are correct. And I was talking about snowflakes earlier, and this has come in from Alex in Edinburgh, who says, Nathan Mervolt, Chief Technical Officer with Microsoft, has spent 18 months building a 100 megapixel camera and has taken the highest resolution photos ever of snowflakes. Beautiful and amazing. Images online. Keep warm. Cheers. I've got to look that up online and have a shifty at that. Now, as you know, we have constantly got our finger on the beating pulse of fashion, you know, and what's on trend, what's in at the moment on this programme. Sea shanties are all the rage just now. We'll bring you more on that next week, but they're not everyone's cup of tea.
Yeah, we actually tried to write a sea shanty for this week.
Well,
and we were doing it over Zoom, and frankly, it was a car crash. It is going to be... it was terrible. So we're going to retry for next week. But on Travelling Folk here on BBC Radio Scotland on Thursday evening, Bruce's guests were a DJ duo from the Geary in Aberdeenshire, and this is fantastic, called the Bothy Bass Boys.
They combine traditional bothy ballads with dance music beats, and here's what Willie and Ian had to say about sea shanties.
Well, I've got to say, sea shanties, it's nae my thing. You ken, it's nae relevant to our ilk, you see, because it's a bit ken colonial venturing and ken mercantilism, that, you ken. It's about taking resources for their lands and out of their countries, and we dinna like that. See, we just mark D with growing what we can live on off the land, you can.
Shiny days are Bailey, he's a stunning chill. It's really pretty hip that you've seen us about a reel. It's like we're here, I know that a lot of sell them in the blue. There's high plenty for it, not the feathers need to throw.
We're about the organic local produce, you see.
Biden local, you can. Biden local. Make use of it, you hear, don't you? Seasonal.
Absolutely. Aye. Couldn't agree
Deep
more.
Studies, scurly.
Scurly.
Simple food.
Simple old-fashioned food. Bile and beef.
Nay rum, sugar, you can. Nay that fancy stuff. Just simple meeps.
First of our drum and bothy release, Biggie Need a Tara Sports, had our folks gone feel.
could hear more from Bothy Bass Boys and their exclusive dance set by looking at the latest edition of Travelling Folk on BBC Sounds. There is a wonderful moment in that clip when it becomes immediately apparent that Bruce McGregor has totally lost control of the interview. <It's> They've gone off the reservation.
Doric hijacked, fantastic. I mean, I really try to imagine what somebody in Spain or Texas is trying to make of that. It's brilliant.
No, well, there's a band across in the Western Isles in Lewis, Pete and Diesel. You know, basically, Bothy Bass is like Pete and Diesel, but with Sharn, by the sound of it. Earlier this week, well, actually, it was about just over a week ago, huge excitement in my local village. Huge excitement because somebody very famous had walked into the Kopi because they're filming Peaky Blinders at Portsoy Harbour at the moment.
Yeah, but it's not the first time the picturesque wee village on the Murray coast has been the star of the silver screen. Back in 2015, the film remake of Whiskey Galore was also filmed there, and I was really lucky enough to get exclusive access to the set, and Ian McLean was the film's producer.
We're looking at a scene just outside the Island Queen down by the pier here in Portsoy, and you can see we've got the camera on the boom. And a couple of the actors are just over the wall there. I think it's Michael Nardoni doing a scene on the shore.
You've probably been asked it 100 times, why remake, you know, a British classic?
I think if you talk to a lot of people who are under the age of 30, they'll say, Whiskey Galore, is that not something about a ship? But and it's a black and white movie, and I think a lot of the younger generation today tend to watch colour. Not only that, it's 1949 this film was released, so I think we're allowed to make a release. It's been quite a number of years, and we are taking Whiskey Galore back to life.
Why Portsoy? Why not the Western Isles?
Obviously, the actual event happened up in the Western Isles, but again, with the constraints involved in making films today, it's very, very expensive to do a film on any island. But I couldn't have chosen a nicer place than Portsoy. I mean, I think it's made for Whiskey Galore. It's, look at that pier over there.
It doesn't take a lot of imagination, does it?
You would think this place hasn't changed a bit since 1940, other than a few little tweaks that we've done to the buildings over there.
So did you get a bit of excitement when you came down here for the first time? Wow, yes.
I did. It was like walking through some form of time trap. You do feel you're stepping back 60 years, so I think it's quite very pleasant.
What about the community? Because, you know, there is inevitably a lot of disruption if you're making a film. How do you bring them with you? You know, you've got roads closed, you've got the harbour closed. People potentially could get annoyed. I don't think it's happening.
I think the secret is they are part of the film. The community's very much involved in the film. I mean, we all hang around the tavern over there. They've been very good in terms of disruption. They're in it, they're extras in it. We're meeting them, they're... Which is very true of the original as well. We've dragged the community into the film.
And you have got a lot of local extras. You haven't bussed in a whole pile of actors from Glasgow.
No, we haven't. We maybe have one or two for continuity purposes, but 95% of the extras are all local, and they've been fantastic.
When an advert was put in the Banffshire Journal, the production team were inundated with would-be extras. Only a lucky few made the cut, the qualification to look like a rugged West Coast Islander.
I play a toddy man.
And you look the part, you've got the beard and big white beard and everything.
I've got the beard. The secret of the beard is to have rubbed salt in the beard, glass of water at the side of the bed, and the hairs come out at night. Nice long beard. That's the way to do it.
You enjoying it?
Loving it. Love every minute.
Brilliant. What about you? What's your character?
I've got two parts. I'm village people.
Yeah, why?
It means I'm village man number 4 and I stand in the background. But today I am selling fish. But I haven't sold a single fish yet, so I'm not very good at it.
You enjoyed it? It seems to be a lot of sitting around.
Well, there is sitting around, but it's great fun watching all the different people and all their jobs.
So are you a real fisherman?
Part-time, shall we say.
Because you're looking the part as well.
And also people have been telling me I've been photographed taken more times this week than I've ever been taken, I think.
Not the end of the line here.
Aye, aye.
You're deliberately unshaven, are you?
Yes, aye. The rough and ready look.
Why did you want to do this?
Well, it's on my wish list, I think, so I could tick this thing off after the film's complete.
In the first film, the images of whiskey-laden small rowing boats is a powerful memory, but to recreate that scene, you have to be able to row, a skill sadly absent amongst the cast. And it was local shipyard manager Stuart Mack, an enthusiastic rower, who answered the call.
The makers of the film came to us and asked for assistance in training their crew on how to row the boats that they were going to be using inside the film.
So how bad were they?
The two guys had never been in a boat before. They hadn't seen a boat as far as I know. And they were asked to run down a slope, jump into the boat and row away as if they had stolen lots of whiskey. So they were quite bad. And they actually sat in the boat the wrong way when they first jumped into it. But they were full of beans and excitement about how to do it. So it wasn't hard to teach them.
So how do you go about teaching somebody to row? I never even thought about it, but presumably it's not that easy. It's not a natural concept, is it?
No, it can be quite difficult. You've got to teach that person to do the very basics that they had to do for that show. So we had to get them to just get into the boat in a safe manner, pick up the two oars and then row. It didn't really matter how they rowed as long as they rowed.
So how long did it take you to actually teach them to row?
Well, we only had about 2 hours that night, so we did the whole 2 hours and then that was it.
So they all miss them when they're gone? Because it looked fantastic.
Yeah, some of the scenes was one of the nights where they were doing night scenes and they had all the lights up and they had the fog over the harbour, artificial fog, and did really look quite spectacular.
Now guys, all of our background artists, listen up. So, those who I've asked to move, you move, all right? And you settle into your end positions, as we know. But remember, even if you're staying static, you're staying still, we still need to see a bit of expression on your face. Don't just all stare blankly. So you can be miming to each other, looking at each other. You're waiting on this ship coming in. You've been waiting a long time. And obviously, as we all know, there's no whiskey on it, so you're a wee bit upset. But we need to see at least something, all right? So don't just stand dead static, at least have some form of movement, you know? Thank you.
The most striking thing when wandering around the set is that Port Soy has been translocated to the Western Isles. It just looks right. And much of that is down to the locals. They were just loving it.
So you're enjoying it?
It's good fun.
Why did you want to do it?
Something different.
The glamour, the excitement?
Oh, it's really glamorous.
Well, tell me what you're wearing.
I'm actually wearing my end shoes and my end cardigan.
Really?
Yes, but everything else is for the costume department.
What about you? What are you wearing?
Everything's for the costume department. Lovely dirty penny cardigan.
It's not a good, I mean, it's not a great look, is it?
Shoes with the sole hanging off, it's quite good.
So were you quite excited when you got selected?
Yeah, I was really surprised, actually.
So there's a lot of waiting around, presumably?
There is, but it's fine because you can look at everything and get an insight into how it's all made, so I don't mind.
So when are you on?
No idea. We just have to sit and wait.
What's it going to be like when it comes out and you're sitting there going, that's me?
Well, we're just going to be looking for us. We're not going to be listening to the storyline. We're just going to be looking for us, I think.
Some of the cast of the 2015 remake of Whiskey Galore chatting to you in there. You know how to make friends, don't you?
Yeah, what right have I to make comments on fashion?
Beats me. I've no idea. We're getting some comments in about snow, though. This is from Jonathan Young saying, just gearing up while listening to your programme to go ski touring in my local Glen Fruin Hills behind Helensburgh in Argyll. I've always thought these hills would be great for skiing, and finally we've got the year and the snow to do it. And Andrew Tate in Kendal says, love the piece on snow and avalanches. Reminded me of doing one of the first avalanche courses up at Glenmore Lodge years ago. We learned, bizarrely, that the deadliest avalanche in the UK happened in Lewes, Sussex, in 1836, when snow swept down a hill behind some cottages that were thought to have some 15 people inside. Listen to this. I think there's now a pub on the site named the Snowdrop Inn, in memory of what happened.
Goodness me. Oh, well. Remember when we buried our producer up in Braemar?
Ah, yes. Yes, Denise. Yeah.
We got a fantastic hurl in the police and Braemar Mountain Rescue Team kind of piece basher.
Yeah.
Blue lights, tracks, and just the most fun you can ever have. And we buried our producer.
Yeah. And but they made us dig it back up again.
Yeah, yeah.
So apparently it's the rules. Continuing with our slightly snowy theme this week, our walk from around the country comes from somewhere that's really seen its fair share of the white stuff this past week. Audio producer Dan Holland lives in Ullapool, and he braved some pretty wild conditions to go to nearby Loch Avroin.
Isn't that just a lovely sound? The sound of your feet breaking through that thick crust on the snow that's sitting on top of, here it must be a foot or so of dry, drifting snow. I'm walking in towards a lock of Roine. I'm just a few miles from the Braymore Junction, outside Ullapool, heading on the road over the Fane towards Anchellach and down to Dundonald. This road's been shut for a few days. It finally got opened just at the end of the week. Until today, there's been no wind. This weather that we've had, the wind has been really calm. The sea in Loch Broom has been flat. But today it's a different story. It's a totally different place. You might be able to hear the wind pushing through some trees just behind me. But it is beautiful. Apart from the sound of the wind, it is so peaceful. There is blue sky all over, not a single cloud. The sun is beating down onto the snow, and it is literally just me out here. I'm just going to keep on walking a wee bit and see if I can get down a bit further to the loch. I came out here, I think it was the winter of 2010. I walked out here one winter's day and the loch was completely frozen, like it will be today. And there was no wind. It was very, very peaceful. I was walking with the dog and my wife and we heard this deep rumbling sound, and almost mixed with whale song. It was a and then the high pitches of that you imagine of whale song. And we stopped because it caught us. It was so unusual. We had no idea what it was. There was nobody around us. It was very calm. But the loch was frozen. And I went back and we talked to some people and asked some questions. And they said that it was most likely that the ice was reverberating on the loch. The ice was working like a drum skin and making pressure waves in the air that was creating the sound that we were hearing. Because the loch here is surrounded by hills. It's a bit open, but it's to the south. We've got the edge of Fisherfield and the Fannochs. Further to the west, a couple of miles away, climbs up to Anchellach. And if you carry on in past the loch, then you can go deep into Fisherfield and right through to Pool U as well. So it's quite a sheltered little bowl, apart from days like this in an easterly gale. But this loch was reverberating. It was the most remarkable sound I've ever heard. And I've never heard it since either. I don't know how much of the wind my microphone is picking up. I've stopped just on the piece of the path because the drifting snow is coming straight in towards my face. And oh, in fact, I'm not even going to stand here next to it because there's another gust. And it's just flinging, pelting at me. I've got sunglasses on. I've got two hats on. I've got a buff on. The only bit of my face that's exposed is around my mouth. And the fine snow hitting that at the wind speed that it is, it's like getting sandblasted. The reason I stopped here is because the way the snow is drifting, there are beautiful patterns in it. It's carving these shapes and little ridges, and they twist and they turn and they dive into ditches and out of ditches. I'm just going to try and sit down in. There's a little... Oh, here we go. I'm just going to sit down here in a wee snowdrift. And a wee patch where obviously a deer has been overnight. I'm going to cooey myself down into his little, or her little hole, and I'm just going to sit here for a minute and just take in this view, because to be honest, there isn't much view. It's all white and it's all blue, but it's beautiful. It's just beautiful. It's so peaceful. It is, apart from the wind, it's so peaceful. But I'm not going to sit here for much longer, because I am becoming part of the snowdrift myself. Ooh. I just put my hand down to get up, and my hand sunk to my shoulder. I'm becoming part of the snowdrift myself. I've only been away from the car for 20 minutes, half an hour or so, and already, as I've turned round, that snow is drifting so fast and so much. All I can see is the remnants of some ski tracks from a couple of days ago from someone. My footprints are gone.
Dan Hollander, just about coping with the cold of Loch Aroin near Ullapool. It sounds fabulous, just lovely.
That noise, that boom.
Yeah.
Boom. It must be so frustrating to be a radio producer and not having taken your recording equipment with you.
Been there, done it.
First rule.
Quite. Time now to reveal this week's mystery bird. I'm going to start off with a wrong answer, and you'll understand why in a second. This comes from Devon, saying, "Greetings from Devon, where the weather isn't very good either. I think the mystery bird might be a goshawk. When you gave out the first clue, it was used for gout. I thought, I know that, but the bird I know they used to strap warm and steaming to gouty feet was the pigeon, and this isn't a pigeon. I'm no good at the mystery bird, though I did get last week's The Chough, Keep Warm," and that was from Helen Swan in Devon. But we've also got a comment from a Liz Swan and a Gail, I don't know whether they're connected in any way, saying, "Is the mystery bird a crossbill? Often heard in our local woods." Andrew in Perthshire got it right. Mary and Colin Abercrombie with Finn the dog got it right. He says, "Being a GP, I knew the bird," or she says, I don't know which, "being a GP, I knew the bird from the clue first. I was asleep at the first sound. The Scottish crossbill is our bird. Depending on which way the beak crosses over, it will either be male or female." Mm-hmm. Okay, fantastic snowshoeing in the Ockles. And then, Sue and Steve Strathdon, Gilbert Duggins and Wesco Bride, Ian Ross Blackburn, Pamela from Edinburgh, Tam Club Peebles, Alexander and Malig, and Keith Sutherland and Blagowry all got the correct answer. So let's hear a bit more about this member of the Finch family.
The Scottish crossbill is unique. It's found nowhere else in the world. A bird of the ancient Caledonian pine forests. And a bird like no other. Well, not quite. It's a chunky, thick-set finch with a large head and a substantial bill. And it's very difficult to distinguish it from the other members of the crossbill family. But it is a beautiful, beautiful bird. Deep, brick-red in plumage, a delightful forked tail. But it's the beak that sets these birds apart from the rest of the finch world. Because the crossbeak is perfectly adapted to exploit the cones of the pine woods. At first sight, it looks strange. Rather than the upper and lower parts of the beak meeting like the rest of the world's species, they cross. And it's clever. Because the pine tree seeds it feeds on are a hard nut to crack. The seeds are hidden at the bottom of the protective scales of the cone, impossible for most birds to get at. But the beak of the crossbill is adapted like a pair of pliers to force the pinecone scales apart, revealing the seeds. And that distinctive bill has, throughout the decades, been the subject of myth and folklore. Folklore, like many birds, attached to the church. According to legend, the crossbill's twisted beak was formed when a flock of the birds attempted to pull out the nails from the cross that Jesus was being crucified. In their desperation, the beaks became twisted as they tore at the nails in his hands and his feet. The birds are nicknamed Christ birds as a result,
and were long believed to hatch at Christmas and fledge at Easter. His dripping blood stained forever the breast of this plucky bird. In gratitude, Jesus blessed the good-hearted bird and gave it the blood-red plumage and the cross shape of the beak as an eternal symbol of his noble deed. Another legend of old Europe is one we've come across before in one shape or another. It was believed by some that the first bird a maiden saw on Valentine's Day would let her know what type of man she would marry. If she saw a blue tit, she would be happy. A raven, she would marry a clergyman. However, if a maiden saw a woodpecker first, she wouldn't get married at all. But if it was a crossbill as the first bird on Valentine's Day, the man she would marry would be very argumentative. Now, in Poland, there's a strange association with the crossbill. In 1893, in Silesia, a region in the southwest, one writer noted that the local weavers supplement their income with an extensive campaign to capture and sell crossbills. In the middle of the village, in front of every house, a caged decoy called out to the masses of wild crossbills in the nearby forest. Limed wands were attached to long poles, and the birds striking them as they flew were taken effortlessly by the bird catchers sitting at their work. Basically, sticky lime is smeared on a stick and the wild birds come in and get stuck. But why? Well, prominent amongst the buyers of these unlucky birds were the nursing staff of German hospitals. But why? Well, these birds were used as therapy for patients with gout and other illnesses. It was very important, though, to select not just any crossbill. Those whose upper mandibles cross to the right cure the ills of men, and those that cross to the left are more effective for female patients. The birds were kept in cages, and the water they drank from was given as a cure for gout. Now, this remedy hasn't been peer-reviewed, so you might want to give it a miss. And catching crossbills is, of course, illegal, and is a 6-month sentence or a £5,000 fine, or both. But it's still known in some regions as the gout bird. Sadly, like many of our songbirds, they were caught and caged to bring song into Victorian salons. And the crossbill was very popular, as it had up to 3 different songs, especially around Christmas. The Christmas finch. They were also kept in nurseries, as they were thought to absorb the infections of infants. And finally, much of the reason for superstition, and on this, on factually sugary ground, was due to the stories that dead crossbills hardly decompose at all. Why? Well, because of their high resin content after feeding on pine seeds. The crossbill, it's quite a bird.
Can I just applaud your modesty in that statement? You know, factually, on this I'm on sugary ground, as if everything else was as solid as cement.
It's fascinating stuff. Listen, we're running out of time here, so I'm going to romp through some correct answers. Dougie Gardy and Glenn Rothes is a winged crossbill. David Long, Scottish Borders. Willie the Farmer in Brechin. Ian in Tullyside in Aberdeenshire. Michael Craig from Sunny Jones even. Barry Sutherland, not many down this part of the world. Fred in Armadale, he's got it right. Neil in Glasgow, because of your latest hint, I think it's a crossbill. And John from Langham got it right as well.
I just find it astonishing anybody got it right, you know, because before we're getting it right, before you gave the clue, which is, it's just extraordinary. Yeah. We were speaking earlier about sea shanties. This came in saying, sailing down the west coast of Norway in a tall ship 20 years ago, singing sea shanties on deck, led by the very fine voice of the captain, was the most magical part of the trip. I recorded some of it, and the sound of the wind in the sails, and the ship's bell was great accompaniment to the singing. Regards, Doreen and Pullman. Doreen, see if you've still got that recording. Let's try and find a way of getting it to us, because we might include it. And Bill Cowie from the Isle of Rona has basically said, great weather for skiing, but do remember we're supposed to be staying local wherever possible. Midweek podcast this Wednesday features hip-hop musician and crofter Gregor Lowry. There's a sentence you don't say very often. From all of the team, Thanks for listening.